Welcome again to Comic Connoisseurs. Tonight we'll be talking about just the general topic, Spider-Man topic tonight. But you of course know my co-host, JT from Saskatoon.
Walloping web snappers.
And also with us is, again, one of our favorite comic book historians, Thomas Revor.
If he has radioactive blood, why does he still have all his hair?
Wrong kind of radiation. Anyways, let's get started here, as we always do, with the solicitations.
Oh, God.
So are we looking at the solicitations for Free Comic Book Day, or what came out this week, Ben? Remind me.
Let's just do what's on the list here.
All right. Yeah, the one that you gave me is for Free Comic Day, yes. Where some of these things are, they're charging too much.
Okay, let's take a look here. Very few titles here. We got, this is going to be a breeze. I mean, we got some Archie Comic Digest, which I know several people are going to be picking that up.
Yeah, the Sonic the Hedgehog Mega Man flipbook looks interesting.
I'd grab that for sure.
Yep.
Because the crossover they did, Worlds Collide, was actually pretty entertaining. Mm.
Down below that, I see something that says, just because it's the public domain does not mean you should use it. From Automatic Publishing, love the name. Hatter M, Far From Wonder, number one.
Mm.
That sound you hear is me repeatedly hitting my head against a wall.
Sounds like you're throwing some wet tomatoes at the wall right now, Ben. I mean, Tom.
Oh, that's my brains, or
what's left
of them after this type of crap. They do have a couple of things that immediately stick out to me. I mean, they've got something from the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund.
Yes. For those of you who don't know, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund is a defense fund that exists to help protect smaller creators from
not just creators. Let me go ahead and ask, do you want me to go into a quick history of this EBLDF?
Yes, please.
Okay, because I was actually around for it. It actually started off because of a lawsuit started back in 1984 against a comic book shop by the name of Friendly Frank's out of Chicago. I know because I used to frequent the Friendly Frank's over in Hobart, Indiana. But they were being sued and attempted to be shut down because they were selling pornography. Now, the pornography was a number of black and white comics, most notably the one called Omaha the Cat Dancer. And yes, it was as much pornography as some of the comics in the back of a Playboy or a Hustler or a Penthouse. So I'm told. I don't read that stuff. But Omaha was a soap opera with sex and furry funny animals.
I think you were right the first time.
Yeah, well, both. However, they did have it, back in a separate partition with notices on the door saying only enter here if you're of age. Well, they started up a fund to help Friendly Frank's defend itself, and I believe that they did successfully defend themselves. I have to double check. It's been a long time. It's been 30 some years, but that's basically how the CBLDF has started, and then it's gone into helping defend creators. Comic companies, defend comic shop owners, and anyone in the business who is being sued and harassed for this type of stuff.
Hmm. Absolutely.
I didn't know that's how it's got its start, actually, but I knew of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. So I come to the recording. I learn something every week.
There are two comic book charities that, I mean, I don't think anybody can say enough about. The CBLDF, even though it is a bit liberal, is one that definitely needs to be paid attention to for the positive work they've done. And of course, the other one is the Hero Initiative.
Mm, yes.
Which is a fund to help the older professionals who have been screwed over.
Help them financially and stuff like that. It's a great thing, because the thing is, it's not even the really old ones that are having problems. I remember a couple of years back, maybe even just 1 year back, what's his name?
Steve Gerber.
Him too, but trying to remember his name. Tom Grummett was having some financial issues.
Yeah. And I'd heard a little bit about that, but I haven't seen Tom since last Free Comic Book Day, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, you should go.
It hurts enough already, Ben. Let's just not talk about it anymore.
Yeah. After we go through some of these other books, you'll see why it hurts so much about Free Comic Day.
Well, I mean, if we go on from, you know, the CBLDF, and thank God I didn't trip over my tongue on that.
Yeah.
The next one down that I'm looking forward to is Project Black Sky from Dark Horse Comics, which I think I've mentioned in previous episodes, basically them reinvigorating their superhero line. So I definitely would have grabbed that. Tom did show us a preview for something from the DC's Futures End, which I think got a
Days of Futures Envy.
The disgusting cold shiver up all our spines would be the best way to describe it. Because
I told you what it is. It's Days of Future Envy. It's basically, yeah. Oh my God, Marvel had this brilliant thing. Well, actually, the thing is this. It's the actual, if you want to be really technical, Days of Future Past was only 2.5 issues. If you want to be really technical about it. But even then, it's we're talking about Claremont on his A game, and he was able to tell a story in 2.5 issues that a lot of these modern writers would take 8 issues to do and wouldn't even hit the same level.
8 issues, 3 spinoffs, and a shit ton of one-shots.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that the only other time I saw something along that lines was back when a young boy was writing, and I wish it was me, was writing the Legion of Superheroes, and he did some stories featuring the adult Legion of Superheroes, to where all the writers after him actually had to kind of tailor Legion so that some of this stuff worked about. And for those who don't know, you may recognize the name of this young boy. This was a teenager by the name of Jim Shooter.
Yes.
Yes, Jim Shooter, former editor-in-chief of Marvel, got his start writing Legion of Superheroes and a number of other things over at DC.
Absolutely. But like I said,
they also have Teen Titans Go number one. Yeah.
That's great kindling right there.
But no, I'm sure if you were to put it into a fire, you would hear Marv Wolfman screaming.
And there would be all sorts of pretty colors.
Yes.
Marv Wolfman screaming, yes, yes, let it burn.
Down below that, Shigeru Mizuki's Showa, A History of Japan, from Drawn in Quarterly. Isn't Drawn in Quarterly the magazine about comics? And I mean, having something like that from Mizuki is, that's one of those things that I think people should look at. Absolutely. Always interesting, always interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really, there's a couple of really good, there's a couple of really, really good picks here because this isn't really just about, superheroes and Archie and stuff like that. I mean, picks like this one is really definitely worth picking up.
Yeah, I don't want to call them a slice of life. They're more, they're almost biographical. This one is biographical. I mean, and this goes up, for the things that I've seen like this are on the level of Spiegelman's Mouse or some of the great mangas that were about the surviving of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is one that I'm definitely going to pick up myself. I may actually go to a comic shop for this.
Mm.
Let's see. Oh, Graphics Publishing has apparently a biography on Dan DiDio.
The dumbest idea ever.
Yes. Graphic Spotlight, the dumbest idea ever. I mean, can it be anything except a story about Dan DiDio and Jim Lee?
It's a story of them being hired.
Yeah. I think it's of them being born.
Are you sure it's not about Heroes Reborn?
Heroes Stillborn?
The New 52? Yeah, let's have this great idea, and let's bring the people back over to the other company so that they can screw them up, too. Yay! Hermes Press, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. This, I'm going to have to look a little bit into this because this can either be very good or I don't know if anyone remembers the Flash Gordon TV series on Sci-Fi.
See how
with the Hawkman?
How? No, I don't. I watched one episode of it. It was as much on Earth. I don't think I ever saw Mongo or Ming mentioned.
Well, the thing is, they did have Hawkman, but the Hawkman didn't have wings. It made you wish that Brian Blessed was back.
Yes, I mean,
God bless that man.
Hey, one of the best things about Blackadder.
Yeah,
I mean, the thing is, Brian Blessed is a wonderful actor. I mean, you can tell when he's having as much fun with it as you are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's slight. We were talking before the show. I mean, I was giving some quotes from Alex Ross, and he has it right. His favorite movie of all time is Flash Gordon, Sam J. Jones, Melody Anderson, Topol, Max von Sydow, Brian Blessed, Timothy Dalton. Oh, great, great movie. Great movie.
One of the greatest theme songs of all time.
Queen. I mean, the only movie theme that I would actually say matches that would be the theme to Highlander.
That's, which is also Queen.
Also from Queen.
I don't even care that's a movie theme song. I just think Prince of the Universe is like one of the best rock songs ever.
Oh, yeah.
Well, but yeah, no, it's...
I love Queen and all, but if you want to talk about, you know, if you want to get a little bit heavier, you know, I always think Zeppelin's great for heavy rock there, you know, a little bit heavier, you know?
Well, yeah.
Well, I mean, Queen is, to me, is like Chicago. I mean, it is more than just a rock and roll band. I mean, for all these people who found out about this great piece of music through, what was his name, the Mike Myers movie?
Wayne's World?
Wayne's World, yes, who found out about Queen through Wayne's World and Bohemian Rhapsody. Wayne knew about it since the 70s, folks!
Well, like I said, I love Queen, but I've been going into Zepp lately.
Well, they're good. Yeah. I mean, of course. Let's see, IDW Publishing, another take on Transformers versus G.I. Joe, which, from what I've seen, I mean, the Transformers, I don't think I've ever seen a Transformers versus G.I. Joe that disappointed me. And this one, it seems to be no exception either.
But then again, there was the first Michael Bay movie.
No, that wasn't Transformers. You know, that was Baybots.
But there was also G.I. Joe there, too.
Well, but they made up for it by getting rid of Bay and making the second one.
So,
where Cobra Commander looked like Cobra Commander, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, that looks good. I mean, and since it's free, go ahead and pick one up.
I'm looking forward to Marvel's two contributions this year.
Yes. I'm looking forward to seeing if they actually reference Rocket's true origins.
The fact that he was a mental health animal from a prison, a psycho ward prison planet?
Yep, written by the great Bill Mantlo, and introduced during Mantlo's run on the Hulk. And then got a four-issue miniseries where we got to find out more about the insane asylum, literally, that Rocket was one of the caretakers for.
I imagine JT would be picking the both of these books up, and he'd put Blue Swede on a continuous loop while reading them.
Ooga chaka. Seriously, I was telling Ben last episode we did, where at the end of the bottom of the poster where it has the release date for the movie, they should just have Ooga Chaka right underneath.
Hey, but, this every Marvel movie has been good. Now, the degree of good has been varying, but they've all been, it's like Pixar movies. Even a bad Pixar movie is better than anything else. But I'm with Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, this is supposed to be a little more on the humor level. As we've seen from the trailer. And some of the people they've got in it, I mean, Karen Gillan without her red hair. Oh, that hurts so much. But, I mean, just, they've got, like with everything else, they've got a cast in there. They've got real actors doing some of this goofy crap. And I'm expecting a movie probably a lot better than Iron Man 2, maybe as good as Iron Man 3.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, have you seen the credit scene from Thor Dark World with Benicio Del Toro?
Yes, as the collector.
And he played that with just the right amount of, like, you know, campy, where's he going?
Yeah, well, the sycophancy, and then finding out that he was a sycophant because he's got something else going on the side. And did you happen to see the Easter egg in that scene?
Ooh, which one?
The cocoon.
Yes, I did see that. And if you know your Marvel cosmic history, people, dear listeners, you should have no idea figuring out what we're talking about.
Let's Jim just Starlin, leave it there. The only man to steal from Kirby and make something just as good as a Kirby creation.
I mean, but you know, we're looking at Marvel. Also, speaking of the free comic book day offering from New England Comics, which
Spawn,
yes, darn ninjas. Which is honestly the first time I ever found a Tick comic. Was digging through a 25-cent bin. I pulled it out. I opened up to a page, and it's literally the Tick walking away, brushing like a crap load of shuriken off his arm, just saying, darn ninjas.
The Tick, I mean, yeah, was part of the Black and White Explosion. And like
that Turtles. That also birthed Turtles, yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, Turtles birthed the Black and White Explosion. But the Tick, unlike so much of this crap that came out during that time, which were Turtles ripoffs, was original. It was funny. It was, I mean, it deserved everything it's gotten and then some. And I mean, and if, for those of you who don't remember, the creator of the Tick, creator, writer, artist of the Tick was Ben Eglin, who went on, who's done more than the Tick. He was also one of the co-producers, I think. I need to double check that. And part of the creative staff of this short-lived TV show called Firefly.
And didn't he also do work on Supernatural as well?
I believe he did. I mean, this is a guy who's got talent to spare.
No, it's the Tick. And okay, I'm going to be honest. I'd pick up the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
Oh no!
Just because I'm still a Power Rangers fan.
You'll pick up both of the things offered by Paper Cuts, won't you?
No, I won't. The movies have ruined the Smurfs for me.
Everybody.
La 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 la.
All right. Well, moving further down the list, we have 2000 AD Special, which you know, if you ever looked into the British comics of the 80s and 90s, you should pick up.
And more than that, I mean, most of you will probably remember 2000 AD because of its greatest success, a certain judge Dredd. Named Dredd. Yep. Let's see.
Red 5.
Wasn't Marvel Man originally published in 2000 AD as well?
I have to look at that. I don't.
I remember it was published in like one of those you know, monthly anthology books that had like multiple different creators contributing stories, and that's what 2000 AD essentially was back in the day.
Yeah. Let's see. Because it started off. Yeah. I'm looking up some of this stuff. Actually, I mean, because you talk about Marvel Man. Let's go ahead and talk about Miracle Man. Simply because Marvel Man was actually another name for Captain Marvel after the lawsuit.
Yes.
A Miracle Man, of course, Alan Moore. And it was actually in a black and white anthology called Warrior.
Okay, that's right. That's the other British book. Okay, there were two British monthly books.
And then they started coming off. They were reprinted over here in the States by Eclipse Publishing.
Yeah.
Kat Yarandwi's company, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's right. See, back in the 80s, there were at least two British anthology books that came out every month that had like different short stories by different authors. There was Warrior in 2000 AD.
Yep.
And, at least two. There's a couple more that I can't quote right now because I just don't remember.
Yep. And do you remember who picked up Miracle Man, writing Miracle Man after Alan Moore left?
Was it Todd McFarlane?
Hell no.
Neil Gaiman, right?
Neil Gaiman. Yeah, and I'm glad Moore won the lawsuit. I am very glad Moore won the lawsuit. Let's see, Valiant has got some of their stuff coming out. The Valiant, the Armor Hunters, special customized edition, and the Valiant Universe Handbook. So, let's see.
That might be worth picking up. I mean, at least to get a sense of the characters and all that.
And that's basically, other than the Hero Clicks Batman Arkham Origins Quick Start Kit.
All right. And that is the solicitations. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have the topic of the show.
Woo!
It's time for intermission, boys and girls.
Like animation? Come listen to Animation Aficionados.
And if you disagree with us, you could be a guest on a future show.
Available on iTunes, the Zune Market, and animationaficionados.com.
Hey, I'm Gary.
I'm Mike.
I'm Chuck.
And I'm Justin.
Join the four of us every week on the Internet's number one and longest-running G.I. Joe podcast, What's on Joe Mind?
It's Joe news, reviews, and interviews like you've never heard them before, delivered right to your MP3 player.
Our guests include Jason Marsden, Kevin Michael Richardson, and Matt Yang King from G.I. Joe Renegades, Larry Hama, Robert Adkins, and John Barber from IDW Publishing, and many more from around the online Joe community.
Yeah, it's guys talking about Joe. Think of it as Joe Talk meets Sports Talk. And we make fun of Chuck.
Right, and we... Hey, again?
Come on, Chuck. We're just kidding, kinda.
Sometimes Chuck makes fun of himself.
Right, and we... Okay, seriously, this is just getting ridiculous now.
It's What's on Joe Mind, every week on the Geekcast Radio Network, InsidePulse.com, Stitcher Smart Radio, and iTunes. Download and listen today.
I suppose I still can't say something about Transformers, can I?
Come on, man.
No.
What about sports?
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's action. It's drama. It's comedy. It's Decian, the superhero webcomic. Decian has superhero antics and sexy girls. Catch updates weekly at Decian.com and NoSuperPants.com.
And now, back to the show.
And we're back to discuss just our general Spider-Man topic show today. So let me start by saying one of the things I want to recommend is Marvel is currently doing like an original... original line of graphic novels for Spider-Man, and one really took my interest was The Amazing Spider-Man Family Business, which is a original graphic novel line which was created and published just to be a graphic novel without any without running in the actual comic book line. It was written by Mark Waid.
Point in its favor.
Yes.
Yep.
The art's gorgeous, by the way. The art is almost painted, really. I actually think it actually is painted, but it's the art's gorgeous. And the story starts where Peter Parker meets this woman who says that she is his sister.
Sounds legit.
Well, you didn't know what secrets Ben Parker took to his grave, so...
Well, the thing is, she claims... she also claims that she's in the family business. She's a spy.
Yeah.
What, you don't think that Mary and Richard Parker were agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yeah, no, I mean, they've always hinted that they were spies throughout the history of Spidey. But, I mean, could they just have... I mean, at least Howard and Maria Stark got a decent death. At least granted, they were rich, but they were normal people.
Yes.
Yeah. True. You don't always have to have, well, Peter Parker's parents, Spider-Man's parents were actually spies. No. You don't need that stuff.
Well, at least they didn't come back as shape-shifting robots. Oh wait.
Yeah, at least Ben Parker wasn't a clone, they did that too.
Well, at least they didn't go and say that he was a scientist that gave Peter Parker a secret genetic legacy that,
Yeah, nobody'd be that stupid.
Mark Webb is.
Did he work on the script, or... Because I would think it'd be unfair to blame the director.
With the whole Peter Parker helping the robber, kind of sort of ruined it for me. It's more than just he was indifferent to act. It's just, no, he's actually helping the guy. He's teaming up with the robber
Webb did not have any writing credits on it. It was basically story idea and screenplay by Kurtzman and Orsi. Thank God they broke up. And Jeff Pinkner.
Yeah. Now, while we're talking about the Amazing Spider-Man...
Not so Amazing Spider-Man.
Well, it's also called the Batman, not the Crap Man, Ben, so just let it go. The one thing I thought they did really well is the update to the boxing match that they had in the film, in a way, because they have that scene in Amazing Spider-Man 1 where Peter pretty well, messes up Flash. Well, he doesn't really mess up Flash Thompson, but how he embarrasses Flash Thompson on the basketball court in the school gym.
The thing is, he didn't really do anything that would get him, get his parents called. I mean, he broke the glass backboard, but at the same time, he did a three-pointer slam dunk
from midcourt.
Exactly. So it's like, okay, he broke the glass backboard, but he just, okay.
Yeah.
The basketball coach is like, no, you're not in trouble. You're on the team.
Well, yeah, but that's why I like.
Who could he really be behind that mask? Is it the boy who jumped from half court to slam dunk,
or the guy who threw the football 200 yards and dented the goalpost?
The goalpost. Let's be fair.
I never saw that. I never made it through that part. Every time I try to watch Amazing Spider-Man, I reach my stupid threshold and I say, that's enough. And so far, I've gotten to Ben Parker's death, and that's as far as I've gotten.
That was pretty fucking stupid, because apparently Ben Parker had a Nom flashback and decided to fight for the gun. Because the thing is this, if you see a guy running down the street with a gun and a bag of money, my first instinct is to hold my hands up and make myself part of the wall.
Yeah.
Well, I won't say anything here or there. It's just this stuff. It was...
My person think this is go for the gun. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, I mean, this, some of this stuff is making the Parker strut look good.
Yeah. Now, well, we're talking about the movies, and this is something I read on a couple of different websites, and I think at least one podcast was mentioned, was Raimi's plan to bring Mysterio into the Raimiverse movies. Because what was the one recurring character actor through all three films?
Well, two of the three you're talking about, obviously.
You're talking the chin.
The chin that could kill, Bruce Campbell. Now, it's been discussed in a couple articles. One was an interview with Raimi. His plan was in the fourth or fifth film. Like, he wanted to do at least six movies and build towards, say, like part 7B or part 6B, like the actual Spider-Man versus the Sinister Six. So his plan was in like parts 4 or 5 that. The Bruce Campbell we see in all three films, it's the same guy. That's Quentin Beck just trying to make a living. And then he would, finally say to hell with it and bust out the fishbowl and the mood fog and, start committing crimes.
I don't know. I kind of think it was Ben Reilly.
Oh.
That's why. So, I mean, it wasn't the same person. It was just a bunch of clones out there that all looked like Bruce Campbell.
Oh, let's not bring the clones into it. Now, that being said, the reason I bring this up is one of my favorite villains of all time. And never mind the stories that he's been used in. Just power set and design. One of my favorite villains has always been Mysterio. Because, you got this guy who's got, like, this Doctor Strange-esque costume, with, like, the grid pattern, the fancy gauntlets, fishbowl head.
The eyes on the collar, yeah.
Eyes on the collar. And I love how he had, like, the reverse or, like, vertical lip, like, audio line that showed on his helmet in, like, the 1960s cartoon series.
Yes.
Stuff like that. And the fact that in the first time he showed up in that series, when he takes the helmet off, he's pretty well Leonard Nimoy, which is at least my suspicion, because when you look at the character, he's kind of got like the Vulcan haircut. He's clearly got like pointy ears, and they don't even call him Quentin Beck. Like at the most, he's called Joe. So, but I mean, it was Quentin Beck, and that's. But just the idea of this guy who he pulls a Batman in his super villainous ways, that he uses special effects and gas and springs in his boots with magnetic plates that lets him stick to the side of the Brooklyn Bridge. And I think if they were, say, God forbid, knock on wood, that Marvel ever decides to follow the Didiot's route. Oh, sorry. Anyone else have a cold chill run up their spine?
No, I also just went, so.
Yeah, and just they say they do a DC Cosmic cop-out and reboot. Mysterio, if you write him correctly, with him being still Quentin Beck and using special effects, if you could run with the idea that even though you know he's this ex-special effects guy, if they never explicitly show him using special effects, you know, just kind of keep that mystery in Mysterio for a while until, you know, how did he always get away and how did this all work? You know, just keep that mystery alive for a while longer is something I've always wished they would have done with Mysterio. And there's been copies of the guy over the years. I mean, there was the call a spade a spade, raped supervillain from Kevin Smith's The Evil That Men Do, who became Mysterio for like two issues and then he was killed. It's just, that's the thing with Spider-Man villains. Anytime a pretender shows up, he doesn't last that long.
Well, even the pretenders that aren't his pretenders. I mean, one time, Spidey fought against someone who's calling himself the Ironmonger, and Spidey's like, that doesn't make sense with you because the other guy at least sold weapons, so he was actually a monger. You're just some guy.
Yeah. I mean, as far as bad copies of villains go, I mean, okay, I like the idea that, you know, his best friend's dad is one of his worst villains in the Green Goblin. But when I started looking into like the past history of Spider-Man comics, and I came across the time where, you know, Harry had, for the first getting on the wagon, you know, he kicked drugs, he was seeing a psychologist, and then his psychologist knocks him out and decides he's going to become a supervillain because through like hypnosis or some malarkey, gets Harry to reveal the location of a Green Goblin cache, and he uses like, I forget the psychiatrist's name, but Harry Osborn's psychiatrist takes like a glider and a costume and starts, you know, I'm going to be the greatest supervillain ever. And then Harry shows up with just a goblin mask on top of his ordinary clothes and a backlighter and schools the guy. And it's like, how bad is that? And if that's not even the worst like copy of a Spider-Man villain. There was I think it was Don Fortunato. It's like this one-eyed Magia? Is like the mafia of the Marvel Universe. He gives it to like this nebbish prick son of his. He gives him the Venom symbiote.
And I remember. Oh, yeah, I remember. And the Venom symbiote's like, you suck. I'm going to let you die.
Yeah, he peels the symbiote peels itself off this douche's body mid jump across like Fifth Avenue from like five stories up or something. And it was like the aftermath of the Sinister 12 where. Like 12 of Spider-Man's, you know, two Sinister Sixes, you know, what could possibly happen? They come after Spider-Man and Aunt May, and this guy, you know, he gets punched once and he starts running away, and the Venom's like, nuts to that, jumps off. This guy falls to his death, and then he latches onto Mac Gargan for like 8 years.
Yeah.
And the last.
People who don't know, that's the original identity of the Scorpion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at the Scorpion, which Vision do you prefer? Because just personally, me, I've always kind of preferred the Scorpion from the 1967's cartoon series.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some more of the lame villains. I mean, we got
to
talk about...
If you don't mind, I'd like to actually go back, because we can talk about Spider-Man. The most important thing about Spider-Man to me was that Spider-Man... originally was a throwaway issue. Now, I mean, a comic that was going to be canceled, Amazing Fantasy, and the publishers at Marvel said, you know what, Stan, do whatever the hell you want. We're canceling it. Doesn't matter. And he wrote something that had a major impact and has continued to have that major impact on the comic industry ever since. I mean, one of the stories that I loved was that he purposely had this teenager. But unlike the people at the distinguished competition, he wasn't Spider-Boy.
He wasn't a sidekick.
He was Spider-Man. And he had, I mean, he wasn't a rich guy. He wasn't an alien from another planet. He was a nebbish. He was a nerd. He was a guy who had tons and tons and tons of his own problems on top of the superpowers. It didn't make things better. It aggravated everything.
Well, yeah, it's... not like Superman, like, you know, Superman is the mask and Clark Kent is the real guy. It's the same, and it's kind of reversed with Spider-Man, how his mask let him break out of his own self. Like, you know, he let him
Yeah.
What's the word I'm looking for? It's like he was freed by the mask. Yeah. He was freed in a way by the mask. Sorry, you go, Tom.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, and it wasn't just that. I mean, because you had, in the original Spidey, you had characters. You had, well, let's start off with the first two, Ben Parker and May Parker. I mean, you had the loving adoptive parents, his aunt and uncle. So even in the beginning, you didn't know what the heck happened to his parents. That was a mystery. He had still had a loving family. You had the people around him, such as, of course, Flash Thompson the other ones, where he was, nerdy Parker, puny Parker. He had to make a living. So, I mean, he was working at the newspaper as a part-time photographer. I mean, who would give a kid a job like that, except that he was coming in with the work? So you had J. Jonah Jameson with his Hitler mustache. You had Betty Brant. And, of course, later on, the cast expanded out.
Robbie, Ben Urich.
Yeah.
Well, the big thing that most people forget is one of the first women that Peter showed interest in was actually Betty.
Yes.
And that's the
good number of years his elder. I mean, she was an adult, he was a teenager, but it was still...
She's only like, 5 or 6 years older than Peter, right?
Right.
Still, that's one of the things I loved that that Sam Raimi kind of got right was, you felt that Peter was like, wow, who's this hot older woman?
Well, yeah. The way I've always looked at it is that Betty may not have had, I mean, he was still a kid. So there was no attraction from his side, from her side. But to him, this is the first woman, an attractive woman, who treated him like a person.
I know. Well, the thing is, you get a sense, especially from the Raimi films, you get a sense that she thought he was a nice kid and all that. But
yeah, and that's really what it was. It took scenes that could have come from any comic book reading boy's life and put him through the magnifying glass of a Stan Lee, Steve Ditko superhero story.
But I want to talk about some of Spider-Man's lame villains. It's one of my favorites.
Like the Looter?
No. He has a... No, I'm talking about the Walrus. Cuckoo-cuckoo.
Oh, jeez.
White Rabbit.
The Walrus first shows up, and he says that he has the proportionate speed, strength, and agility of a walrus. And Spider-Man starts laughing because a human being is smaller than a walrus, so to have the proportionate speed, strength, and agility of a walrus, he's actually weaker than a walrus.
Well, and let's be honest, because you talk about that, and that was during the time where they were getting desperate for something non-stupid and failing. That was the Marvel team-up story,
The one with the Hostess Cakes?
No, this was actually a real Marvel team-up story, and his team-up was with the Amazing Frogman.
Oh.
Be folks to see on that one, but I'm pretty sure it was stupid. There was
Frogman was the son of a Daredevil villain, Leapfrog.
Yes. The character was overweight, nebbish, and over-enthusiastic because he had the suit, and he was going to get himself hurt. I mean, I would much rather talk about, because you talk about villains. Look at some of the villains that Peter has had. I love the fact that they went with, a lot of them were animal-themed like he was. I mean, Spider-Man, right off the bat, what his powers are. And who did he have? He had Dr. Octopus. He had the Rhino. He had the Vulture.
Craven the Hunter.
Well, Craven wasn't so much part of the animal based.
He had a lion motif going on.
Yes,
true.
But it was, and again, it wasn't just generic. Why did Catwoman rob banks? Who cared? Why did Lex Luthor want to take over the world? Well, because he was a mad scientist. Why did the Lizard attack people? Because he had accidentally injected himself with a serum to try to regrow his lost arm, and it took over his mind and body. Background!
Well,
characterization!
That's true. But the thing is, the reason why all of Spider-Man's villains are animal-themed was actually explored by JMS.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. It was a terrific storyline that Straczynski did when he was writing Spider-Man 8 years ago, 5 years
talking
ago.
About is, you're talking about the Ezekiel storyline.
Yeah, the basically the spider totem.
Where it's the question is, did the spider give Peter Parker his powers because it was radioactive, or did the spider choose Peter Parker for his power to pass on the totem powers?
Yeah, I mean,
physical or science?
Well, that's like how the end, like the last issue of the Ezekiel story, where he's talking to like this shaman character, Peter, and the guy says, "Is like, you know, you can explain to me all the laws of thermodynamics, and I can still say that the sun will come up tomorrow because it does." You know, I mean, that was the great thing.
But it also, go ahead.
I was just saying, like, before we get back into the villains and the totemic powers there, one of the things I did like about that JMS storyline, because that was around the time Peter had the organic web shooters, and how there was an issue where you see him use actual spider powers. Like, you know, he spins a web and he feels the vibrations, or he pulls off his glove and feels, you know, where the airflow is coming from to find people, where he's got to, like, crawl through a hole and lift stuff out of the way while rescuing this little girl, and she just hangs on, and his, you know, his Velcro powers stick to, like, make the girl stick to him. That was one of my favorite things about the JMS, but sorry, back to the villains.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was going to say, because in the same storyline, one of the things he had, I mean, did the powers come from the spider passing him on, or this radioactivity? And yet, Straczynski actually had Peter say, it doesn't matter. He was being hunted by this villain that devoured totems from people to keep himself immortal. And how does Peter defeat him? Because
eating his face?
Nope. The spider totem powers could not defeat him. So what did he do? He went to the other aspect of Spider-Man and inundated himself with radiation, which the villain couldn't handle. And it actually, I mean, it basically killed the villain.
And then he came back.
Mean, yeah. But I mean, it was, he isn't one or the other. Peter Parker is many, many, many things, both in powers and personality. And that's always been the heart of what Spider-Man is. He's the guy who, he's the nerd with the heart of gold, the one who's handsome without realizing that he's handsome, the one who attracts the pretty girls that he shouldn't be able to because of that core of self-confidence which he actually got from the spider powers. All the great characters in there, lame villains included, but it's always been the supporting cast that was the true power of the Spider-Man comics. I mean, you couldn't have gotten, I mean, would Spider-Man be as popular nowadays if not for the framing of Spider-Man for the death of Captain Stacy, the father of his girlfriend? Would Spider-Man be even known nowadays if not for the death of Gwen Stacy?
That's true.
Which they use in this movie, I'm told.
Yeah, she dies.
Yeah. Things like, I mean, the love from afar, the unrequited love of Captain Jean DeWolf, Peter David's first stories for Marvel,
yes, were
the Jean DeWolf stories. And her death at the hands of the Sin Eater, who happens to be a former lover of hers, where she had a life that Peter knew nothing about. You had such great characters, and it's a great playground to deal with. Part of the strength of the Ultimate Universe, to me, is the fact that you had such great creations in the first place with Peter Parker and with Spider-Man and his supporting cast. And they were able to take all the stuff there, will away some of the chaff, and improve upon it, and make some mistakes of their own, of course. But go through and do things differently and still have that same great strength.
Well, no, because, I mean, for older fans of Spider-Man, they might know him primarily for the death of Gwen Stacy, whereas newer fans would know him for, say, one of the biggest debacles in the history of Spider-Man, which is the Clone Saga, which I've read, a friend of mine has the complete Clone Saga collection trade paperbacks. There is stuff in there that I wish would have worked better than it did. Primarily when you go and you look at the back, like the history, like behind the scenes of the Clone Saga, it was only supposed to last like 6 months.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it was supposed to end with introducing, you know, they introduced Ben Reilly, there's the Scarlet Spider, and then they would ask the question, and it would be like, you know, what it would let it lie for however many years is, who is the real Spider-Man, Ben Reilly or Peter Parker? Because originally the Clone Saga, you know, hails back to one of my favorite Spider-Man stories from the 70s, like the original Clone Saga in the 70s with the original Spider-Clone and the Jackal, who, again, one of the creepier Spider-Man villains. And it's Peter Parker's biology professor from college who falls in love with Gwen Stacy.
The Jackal.
Which is kind of like this poor man's Joker in a way, because...
If you want to talk about who Spider-Man's Joker is, we got to talk about Norman.
See, I disagree. I disagree. I mean, because Norman Osborn is, to me, he's Peter's Lex Luthor, not his Joker.
But the thing, he has that unpredictability factor where he will do something batshit, insane, crazy, out of the left field because he felt like it.
But that isn't the Joker to me. I mean, the Joker is the flip side of the Batman. I mean, they're both got so much in common and very little differences. If you're going to talk to me, what was the Joker to Peter Parker, it's Otto Octavius. Because they have so much in common. They were both the nerdy intellectual types. They were both scientists. But where Peter got the break with the spider powers, which allowed him to release some of his inner confidence, Otto Octavius never had that. And even after he still, and this is original comic stuff, folks, not the movie, as much as great as the movie was. But it was, even then, he still tried helping people out. And it was when the accident occurred that he said, screw it all. I'm sitting here, I'm being injured, I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm getting nothing back for it. Time for me to get something back for it. A tact that Peter Parker could have easily gone down and did in a couple of what-if issues. So, I mean, to me, that's why Norman Osborn isn't his Joker. He doesn't have that much in common with Peter Parker. Otto Octavius does.
That's true. But like I said, is the one thing that Norman Osborn is known for is he can make the weirdest out of left field decisions on what he wants to do just to torment people because he wants to. And a good example of this is Dr. Octavius and Norman Osborn teamed up briefly for a while. And while they were teamed up, Otto mistakenly made the decision to have a heart-to-heart with Norman, where he revealed he used to have a fiance before his mother forced him to break up with her. And Norman decides, okay, he's going to do Otto a solid favor in the only way that the Green Goblin decides a favor is, by having his former fiance run off the road and then infect her with AIDS.
Yeah, some of these writers just really...
But that, to me, is what Norman Osborn's all about. It's about, you know, just being batshit crazy.
Well, to me, it's not. I mean, it was always... The Green Goblin was Jekyll and Hyde. It wasn't about being batshit crazy. It was about the inner demons which a person has. And someone like Norman Osborn has a hell of a lot of them. Get in control.
And I think that's Willem Dafoe did a great job of displaying that.
I can't think of anyone else who could have done it other than Dafoe.
The mirror scene, man.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't care. Oh, you can see his mouth moving under the... I don't care. There is no other Green Goblin.
Yeah, there's no one else who could have played... And from what I've seen from the trailers, I don't know who they've got playing Norman Osborn in this one, but he's
there. There is no Norman Osborn.
There is.
Chris Cooper.
No, you're thinking... No, they have a Harry Osborn in this one.
No, he actually shows up in like one of the first trailers. You see him briefly, and then yeah, Chris Cooper. From what I've read about the Goblin in Amazing Spider-Man 2, is Norman Osborn is dying from some weird genetic disease that Harry is eventually going to develop because it's hereditary or some BS like that, and part of the quote unquote cure is what basically turns Harry into the Beavis Goblin. I mean, the Green Goblin.
Well,
because when you see that full-on headshot of Harry Osborn as the Goblin in this thing, it's like, fire, need TP for my bundle.
It really is. But the part of the problem with that to me is you know, number one is this is confirmed in the script. Basically, Harry Osborn's like, hey, Peter, I need to talk to Spider-Man because Spider-Man might be the only way I can be cured of this hereditary disease that's going to kill me horribly. And then Spider-Man shows up and he's like, hey, Spider-Man, I really need your blood because your blood will cure me. Spider-Man is like, no, screw you. And then he's like, and then Harry's like, okay, I'm gonna take all this mushed up dead spiders from our testing chamber and inject myself with that instead. And he turns all Green Goblin.
So basically, he's not Green Goblin. He's half Green Goblin, half Michael Morbius.
Yes, and like I said, part of the problem is, you know, if Spider-Man said, yeah, here's my blood, and go cure yourself, and so you won't turn into this horrible thing. If you use this alternative cure, it's like, it actually is literally Spider-Man's fault that he turned into Green Goblin.
Can we just get the third movie done and over with so we can get to a new reboot and get a new, maybe somebody good like Sam Raimi?
Well, maybe they could like start number four, have Toby back and be like, and act like this never happened, just have Andrew Garfield show up as like a waiter in a scene.
No, so what I you're saying, he wakes up, it was all a dream, and Patrick Duffy is in the shower.
Yes.
I will say, because I've seen all of the alternative media, non-comic book versions of Spider-Man. I grew up on the original 60s cartoon, bad animation and all, Attack of the Spider People. How did Spider-Man web swing all the way from New York to Florida to fight the lizard? I don't know. To the live action with Nicholas Hammond, where
I love those so much as a kid, even though they were so bad.
They were so bad. I mean, even
they Spidey's were they were crawling. so bad that you know who asked animators to draw Peter Parker to look like him.
Good heavens! Both the original Spider-Man cartoon from Marvel, which got lasted one season and then became Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Yeah.
Thank you, Angelica Jones. Good heavens. I mean, the live-action Japanese Spider-Man.
And actually, because of that, all of Super Sentai is officially part of the Marvel Universe canon. It is an actual alternate world in their multiverse.
Because the thing is, Spider-Man is the first Super Sentai character with a giant robot.
I believe so.
Spider-Man is the genesis of Power Rangers.
Well, I'd go back to Goldar Silvar and the Space Giants for that, or Johnny Sacco, but that's another podcast altogether.
He has the morpher on his hand that he uses to call the robot,
which is a giant leopard.
Yes.
I still don't understand that one. But I mean, there's so much on there and so much beyond. I mean, and of course, to me, the first and second Sam Raimi Spider-Man films are not just great superhero movies, but great movies, period.
Absolutely. I mean,
especially part two.
Yeah, Spider-Man 3 and the Amazing Spider-Man movies show what happens when a studio interferes.
And to me, nothing can quite match the high velocity of the train fight in Spider-Man 2, because that's exactly the kind of Spider-Man battle you're looking forward to, where you see Spider-Man and one of his villains, you know, just a high-octane fight.
But just as much, I mean, I know that a lot of old geeks had our heartstrings tugged when they had the direct copy of the cover of Spider-Man No More.
Yes.
With the costume, even the way it was draped in the trash can, and Raimi admitted that he used that cover. Raimi is a fan. The people they've got doing Amazing Spider-Man, they're not fans, they're movie people. They don't give a crap about it.
The funny thing to me is the Amazing Spider-Man costume from the first movie looks like shit. It really does look like shit. Because it looks like it's someone from a bunch of Harlem Globetrotters basketballs, and it has light up action web shooters that looks like kid toys. It looks like shit. And then they're like, oh, we're going to improve the costume for number two. And number two, it looks like the Raimi costume. It's like, yeah, really?
I actually love the fact that the director said, well, we wanted a costume that looked like a kid could sew it together, which is why they used sunglass lenses. Okay, I was a kid. I was a damn good sewer. Yes, I took home ec. All the girls were in it. And
God knows what the score is.
I'm sorry. You can't have anyone except a professional seamstress make something as intricate, especially with those stupid-ass gloves and the blue going everywhere, as the Amazing Spider-Man 1 costume. I still have problems with, I really think that Ditko did it, the original Ditko costume was right. A kid could sew that together.
Yes.
Even the web pits.
The original black and red, yes.
Yes. I still have a little bit of a problem. I mean, the web shooters were a stretch, but it was fantasy. Well, it was Amazing Fantasy. 15.
Number 27.
You just don't get that stuff with modern stuff. I mean, and up until one point, you actually had, I mean, Spider-Man was real life in superhero, even marrying a supermodel who happened to be the daughter of his neighbor's. So, I mean, the niece of his neighbor and his aunt's best friend. So wasn't outside of the realm of possibility.
And the thing that I love about it was, in the original Ditko run, you don't ever get to see Mary Jane Watson, because the thing is, her face was always covered by someone's hand or someone's shoulder or a vase, and it's like...
It took John Romita Sr. Thank God that Ditko didn't draw.
God bless that man's hands.
But, like I said, the thing is, Mary Jane Watson was a running gag of, here is this woman that his aunt's trying to set him up with, and he's like trying to dodge her. So you, the reader, for years are imagining she's got to be a dog.
Yeah, she had a great personality.
And then when you finally see her, it's like, wow, Peter, what have you been doing ducking this woman for all your life?
Oh, he was kicking himself so hard inside his own mind right there.
Well, and it wasn't just that. I mean, because back in the 90s, was it? Was it late 80s, 90s? They had an issue before the wedding, before they're even back together, where Mary Jane admits that she knows that he's Spider-Man, and they have a heart-to-heart, and we get the secret origins of Mary Jane Watson, which is where some of the things you saw of Mary Jane Watson's home life in the first Raimi film came from this, where she was an abused child, she had an older sister, and she wasn't going to let any of this stuff just bother her. I mean, rather than get it down, Mary Jane became a party girl.
Yes.
And we get to see a lot of the tragedy that she spun off. Why did she go into acting and become a model? Because it kept her happy. And yet we see she's had as much tragedy in her life of a different sort that Peter Parker has had as well. And they connected on that level as well. They didn't just like each other. They were friends.
Yes.
And they were... I don't want to say, well, I would say soulmates, because they had so much in common that the supermodel superhero thing was an aside. Damn you, Joe Quesada.
Quesadilla. But to me, the biggest thing is, you look at all the other women in Peter Parker's life. And
Liz Allen.
Liz Allen is
Liz Allen, Betty Brant, Deborah Whitman.
Yeah, Deborah Whitman is one of my favorite stories, because it's so ridiculous what they did with her.
It was such a great story until they sent her off the deep end because she found out he was Spidey.
Yeah, well, but what happens is, the thing that puts Deborah Whitman sort of off into her own little corner, and the only interesting thing about her is when we first introduced to her, you know, by that point, Peter's been dating solid eights and nines, you know? And Deborah was like about a 6 or a 7. Yeah. So,
well, she was an 8 in disguise as a 6.
Yeah, that's about right. But like I said, is you know after women like Mary Jane and Felicia, it's like, you know, it's...
Well, this was before Felicia.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But you get my point. It's right. So this is a woman that's more down to earth, more, you know, dare we say, normal standards.
She was a scientist like him. They had the whole nerdy thing going together. It was geek love.
Then she starts thinking he might be Spider-Man, and her therapist tells Peter, okay, you dress up like Spider-Man, and that will shock her out of her psychosis. And Peter's like, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just tell her the truth. And he did, and then that shocked her out of her psychosis.
Yeah.
And then she wrote a tell-all book about it.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, to me, I mean, I think other than Mary Jane Watson, well, other than Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane Watson, I think the greatest relationship from a writer's standpoint and a reader's standpoint has to be Felicia Hardy, the Black Cat. Not because she was the great love of his life like Wendy and MJ was, but because she loved Spider-Man. Couldn't stand Peter Parker, but she loved
that.
Spider-Man.
Where where he first time he demasks and she's all like, "Oh, put that shit back on."
Yeah,
actually, the something similar happened in the Ultimate Universe, except she puked.
Well, because she didn't. She thought he was just some scrawny guy. And then she sees it's a kid. And he comes up with the big, you know, Barbara Hershey meets Steven Tyler, you know, puckered up lips, and she's like, "Oh God, I almost raped a kid."
I'm pretty sure it was completely voluntary.
Yeah. But no, sorry, you go, Ben. Or Tom, sorry.
Yeah, it goes back to the characterization. It goes back to the characters. It goes back to people. I mean, you can see this happening. You can see an adrenaline junkie like Felicia Hardy going through. And again, this is comics, not the cartoon, 90s cartoon, which the less said about the better.
Yeah, that's true.
The Nicholas Hammond live-action Spider-Man looked like King Lear.
I'd argue the first couple of seasons of the 90s cartoon weren't that bad.
Yes, they were.
But you could let me have just one moment, Ben. Just one is all I'm asking.
I will agree with you. The first season and a half were good. Yeah. I had optimism about it, and then it didn't.
Was slowly chipped away episode by episode.
Yeah, it suffered. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, until they end the series on Madam Web and Spider-Man trolling the multiverse looking for Mary Jane after it was revealed that Mary Jane was really a water or Hydro Man-based clone. And then there's episode.
And the Secret Wars episode, and then the Crisis on Infinite Spider-Man episode. It all became what Marvel was doing in the 90s, you know,
comics, you know.
Yeah, it was multi-arc versus multi-arc versus multi-arc. Not stories, not people, but just individual.
Although they did
something
have
about it.
Yeah, although they did have the perfect voice for the Kingpin in that series, Roscoe Lee Brown.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I got to bring up is, you know, we bring up the women in Peter Parker's life, and the thing is, you know, with characters like Felicia and Mary Jane, you know, these are characters that do have lots of depth to them. I mean, yes, they are very attractive, but they also have a lot of depth to them. And there was actually, I remember once, I can't find the book again, but a friend of mine sent me a panel of an issue that was drawn by Frank Cho. There was one panel that had Frank Cho drawing Mary Jane and Felicia staying next to each other.
Well, and of course, I mean, if we have to talk about it, Spider-Man has given us what is unarguably the best comic book story of all time. I mean, you can take Watchmen, and yeah, Watchmen is great and all this. You can take Kingdom Come, but The Boy Who Collected Spider-Man will touch you like no other story has.
If you don't at least get one or two tears welled up in your eyes after reading that, you don't have a soul.
Yeah. And I mean, just the complete, I mean, it's fanboy meets Spider-Man, and then you get the twist of the knife in your back at the end. And you can see, I mean, it's such a, on one aspect, it's a great look at the history of Spider-Man. But
yeah,
Peter David again, I mean, where it's just such a great story, and it's encapsulated, and it's got you going, and then you see the reality of it. Yeah, it was adapted for the 90s cartoon, wasn't it? They had one episode of the 90s cartoon that was based off
Spider-Man gets amnesia and teams up with Dr. Octopus.
They made a little girl instead of a little boy.
Yeah.
You know, to really drive the point home.
There you go. I found it. It's a very small panel, but it's still Frank Cho drawing them staying next to each other.
And I love the look in Felicia's faces. I will claw your eyes out, bitch.
Frank Cho, I mean, other than Frank Cho and Adam Hughes, two of the greatest people to draw women ever.
Dodson.
Draw naturally attractive women, not Image Comics torpedo tits.
True. Now, we're talking about some of the women in Peter's life, and to be fair, we got to talk about one of the men that looms largest in his life outside of Uncle Ben, and that is the cigar-chomping, spider-hating newspaper editor that we all know and love. Played perfectly, perfectly by J.K. Simmons.
There is no one else in the world. I have to take a look to see who played him in the 70s live-action show, and he was a good J.J.J., but J.K. Simmons is...
Yeah.
Certain people are born to play certain roles. Chris Reeve as Superman, Linda Carter as Wonder Woman, J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson.
No, yeah, was it Asner in the 90s cartoon? You go back there. He did a fair J.J., but
he was Lou Grant.
But you look at the it's like, who am I thinking about? It's like Kevin Conroy voicing Batman. Yes. J.K. Simmons is so perfectly suited. He's doing the voice of J. Jonah in all the current Marvel animated series, because now you got the Marvel animated universe and the cinematic universe. And like we've said before in this show, we all pray to Jack Kirby day and night that someday the Marvel movies will include Spider-Man. But he's doing the voice of J. Jonah Jameson in all the ongoing animated series. There's even talk that people are lobbying hoping that he shows up in the Amazing Spider-Man series as JJ at some point. And how can you not love this guy? For years, I actually hated, he's grown to be one of my favorite characters in the Marvel comics, never mind Spider-Man. But for years, I actually kind of hated him a bit. Cause it was like, where do you get off, you utter douchebag, terrorizing this guy who's is fighting crime, and all these editorials. You have absolutely no evidence. How did your paper not fold 8 years ago for all these anti-Spider-Man editorials? And then they have, the one thing where it's just Jonah in a room, single light on him sort of thing, and he speaks aloud like he hates Spider-Man because he's the man that he could never be. And I mean, they added to that years later in one of his flashbacks where, heroes are the bunk, I believe was the term, where you see Jonah as a young reporter and how him and his then girlfriend were being threatened by mobsters. And, he just has this lifelong distrust of heroes. And
yeah, I mean, JJJ for the longest time was the joke. I mean, he was ranting about Spider-Man and nobody took him seriously. Readers never took him seriously until we got to see a little bit about who JJJ is. And the way they handled it, you have to look at the Ultimate Universe JJJ as well, where he starts off the same way. I mean, he's ranting about Spider-Man. Spider-Man is terrible. Spider-Man's a criminal. Until the scene where he is kidnapped with Spider-Man by the two chameleons. And he finds out who Spider-Man is. And it strikes him, it's just this boy who's had all this tragedy, who's doing this thing. And he becomes a father figure to Peter Parker. He turns a 180 about Spider-Man now that he knows why Spider-Man is doing this.
Absolutely. And well, the thing is, it really is later writers who soften J.J. Because early on, you got to remember, J. Jonah Jameson is directly responsible for creating at least two of Spider-Man's rogues.
Yep. The Scorpion and the Spider Slayers.
And he also had a hand in the Fly. Human Fly. Whatever. Less said about him, the better.
Yeah.
But really, it was that, later writers did soften him quite a bit to where he's not only a journalist, he's a journalist that would... not give away his sources, even if, a good example of this is in the Sam Raimi movie, J. Jonah Jameson was threatened by the Green Goblin. He was going to be killed if he didn't say, hey, that kid that just walked out of here is my source. And he didn't know Parker that well from anybody else at that moment. And he refused to rat out Parker and was prepared to die for it.
See, and I mean, as to me, just as great as that scene was the scene where Parker is talking to him about how can he say all this stuff about Spider-Man. I mean, isn't he afraid that he'll be sued for slander? And Jameson, I mean, after barking, yeah, I mean, before that, Jameson is barking orders and he's being a complete terror. And then he gets into where he's comfortable. He's talking about newspapers at this point, and he kind of softens and says, no, he's libel. Slander is spoken, libel is printed. It would be sued for slander, for libel. Yeah. And that's just, I mean, again, perfect casting for this. And that gets to the heart of JJJ. JJJ is a newspaper person. He's a true blue reporter, printer's ink running through his veins.
Yes, and the funniest, one of the things that leads me to is actually, there was an arc in She-Hulk where She-Hulk sues the Daily Bugle on behalf of Spider-Man. this is a great arc because at first the lawsuit is for millions of dollars, and Spider-Man actually takes the stand, and Spider-Man says, I've been trying to think of years why Jonah hates me, and I think I came up with it. He doesn't like me because I'm black. And then everyone looks at Jonah. And Jonah's like loosening his collar like, actually some of my best friends are.
Yeah. Honestly, one of my favorite Jonah moments didn't even happen in an issue of Spider-Man. It happened in an issue of Uncanny X-Men during the Operation Zero Tolerance storyline. Beautiful art by Joe Madureira. I can't say enough. I love his work. And it's where you have this guy named Bastion who was revealed to be like some uber Nimrod sentinel.
Yeah.
And it's not the greatest character, but I love this scene because he basically comes in with a DVD full of all the dirt on Graydon Creed, who is this, you know, anti-mutant bigot who has loomed large in the X-Men comics for years. And he basically wanted to take him down for whatever reason. I don't recall. But you see Jonah sitting there just puffing on the stogie, just not even glaring daggers, just trying to figure Bastion out. Well, Bastion does his spiel. And then Jonah has this absolutely gorgeous speech about, you know, I could use this. And I'm not going to back off, and I'll tell you why. And as he does this, he basically sets something on fire in his ashtray and puts the DVD in there to destroy it. And he goes off in a terror telling us, like, you know, speaking about his journalistic integrity. And knowing what you know about Bastion, is like, how ballsy is this for JJ to not even back down? In fact, I'm going to keep coming at you because no one can figure out anything about you. I'm going to print your secrets all over the front page of my newspaper. Like, he's calling out this guy who could effectively end his life, his bloodline. Like, he could knock every one of his family members out of the tree, and he doesn't back down. And that was around the time that I really started to turn the page on JJ. I was like, you know what? I don't care how much he hates Spidey. This guy's gold.
And back to the lawsuit storyline, because the storyline had an unexpected humorous twist, where Peter Parker was called to the stand the next day. And first thing Peter Parker says is, wow, talk about deja vu. And they're like, what are you talking about? He's like, okay. And Peter had to admit on the stand that he had at times doctored photos of Spider-Man appearing to be Mysterio. Or he also had to admit that he at times, quote, at times posed as Spider-Man for photography to make money. So Peter Parker was then named co-defendant in the suit, at that point, Spider-Man goes to his counsel, She-Hulk, and says that his demands have changed from $1 million to Peter Parker and J. Jonah Jameson have to wear chicken suits, stand outside the Daily Bugle, and hand out apologies all day for one day.
See, I think there was one scene that, to me, was one of the great things about JJJ. And that was in the Spider-Man 2099 crossover issue, where both Spidey and where Peter and Miguel have switched places in time. And Miguel's going to take this opportunity because he knows that this is the day that all the superheroes have disappeared. So he's over at the Daily Bugle in, of course, his Spider-Man 2099 outfit. And they're looking up certain information about some of the companies and what's going to happen. And that's when JJJ comes in. I mean, you may have changed your costume and just ranting on him as if he was Peter Spider-Man. And he just whips off the mask and says, "I'm not who you think I am. I'm from the future, where Spider-Man is a revered hero. He is talked about reverently." And Jonah just looks at him and says, "Well, and what about me? I'm a fool. I'm a joke, aren't I?" And Miguel just looks at him and says, "You're nothing. You're not even a blip in the history books. You're not a footnote. For all of your venom and all your rhetoric, you aren't remembered."
Ooh.
Burn.
And it gives...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Peter David again. Some of my favorite stories are Peter David's. But it gives a great look at some of what it is. Now, of course, it also had the thing that printer's ink causes cancer, but... But it goes to that. I mean, because we could talk about Spider-Man 2099. We could talk about Ultimate Spider-Man. We could talk about all the stuff that, you know, goes derived from the source material, which was such a great thing. And I don't care whether you say it was Stan Lee or Steve Ditko or the combination of the two. Spider-Man was created and shook up the entire comic industry.
That's certainly true. But I want to bring up one of my other favorite J. Jonah moments. It was during the Avengers, the first run of the Mighty Avengers, where Spider-Man officially joins the team. This was during the Frank Cho, you know, art run, and mm-hmm. the Avengers, you know, Captain America, the Avengers, Iron Man, they go to J. Jonah Jameson and say, "Hey, can't you just drop at least once? We're going to give you the exclusive on the Avengers new team if you agree to drop your vendetta against Spider-Man." Jonah agrees, and then, instead, nothing negative about Spidey in the press release, but it's like, he talks about all the other Avengers. He's like, you know, Luke Cage, you know, former drug dealer, and... And Spider-Man, yeah. Former terrorist, and it's like, wow... You did not think this through, did you guys?
Yeah. It really, I mean, JJJ has been a great foil for Spider-Man for a lot of years. And the way that they've updated him recently, after the Sam Raimi movies, most notably, has been terrific. He turned him in from a Johnny One joke to a living, breathing, and definitely respectable journalist.
And, during the brief time where Peter Parker revealed his identity, there was an issue where Peter Parker and J. Jonah talked briefly, and it was actually after this conversation where Jonah revealed why it hurt so much to him, because he always thought Peter Parker was like the last honest guy, and for him to be Spider-Man to him like tore him up.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was actually an issue drawn by. You should know this one, JT.
Oh, God.
Todd Knock.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Young Justice.
Knox, yeah, during Knox's run on Spidey.
Well, wasn't that, like, sensational Spider-Man when he was on there? Because I don't think he was on Amazing.
It wasn't on Amazing. It's funny, because you mentioned Young Justice, and I remember that was some of the Peter David issues, so that him and Knock, it was a big deal about him and Knock working together again.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just trying to think of other people that, like, Spider-Man, out of his supporting cast, aside from Jonah, you look at some of the other characters that, like, really, not necessarily effective, but kept Peter on the right course. I mean, you have Robbie Robertson, you got Ben Urich, who, I think he started in Daredevil and then kind of crossed.
He did start in Daredevil.
No, he didn't.
You know.
You sure?
He started in Spidey. Back during the Master Planners, okay. Yeah, back during the Master Planner series.
Oh, okay.
Where Doc Ock was actually under another pseudonym, the Master Planner. So, I mean, that was a long time ago.
Yeah. But, I mean, you look at some of the, and even the modern supporting cast, like, Spider-Man's always had one of my favorite supporting casts, because it's fluid. It's not always Perry White, Jimmy Olsen, Lois Lane. It's not always Alfred and Commissioner Gordon. Like, people come in and out of his life. Now, One More Day is one of the worst Spider-Man stories of all time.
What is it?
One of the worst stories of all time.
Yeah, no, what was?
That was the one where Mephisto made a deal with Peter and Mary Jane to save Aunt May after she got shot.
I'm hearing words, but they don't make any sense. What is this?
Okay, moving forward. they had Brand New Day, which was, you know, a great invigoration and great time for Spider-Man. Some really great Spider-Man stories, you know, constantly rotating artists and writers. You know, not saying greatest of all time Spider-Man stories, but some really entertaining ones. And in this time, we got a whole slew of new characters. I mean, they brought back Phil Urich's nephew, Phil, or Ben, yeah, because this, again, Uncle Ben, which they kind of played with later on when Phil went nuts and became, like, the umpteenth Hobgoblin.
Again.
You brought, again, and, well, he was the Green Goblin first, but he was a hero. And then you brought in, was it Nora Winters, who is, like, the Lois Lane of the Marvel Universe, but kind of even more of a bitch in a way, and kind of played off, you know, Spider-Man. And, you know, you had Phil Gonzalez, who was like this roommate, became roommates with Peter Parker and eventually got tied in with this conspiracy of these cops who were trying to frame Spider-Man for, you know, killing these criminals that they did, because there's all this wealth of, like, you know, discarded spider tracers and the odd web shooter and such like that. And even to go back to JJJ, they had the great shakeup where, you know, at the beginning of Brand New Day, he's still the publisher of the Daily Bugle. He has a heart attack. His wife, Marla, sells their share, so he's no longer in the business. Eventually becomes mayor of New York City. And after that happens, him and Marla sell, like, their remaining, like, 5 shares and the official title of Daily Bugle to Frontline, which is this newspaper that Ben Urich and this other reporter chick, Sally something, I can't remember which, you know, so it becomes the Daily Bugle again. And this is after the original Daily Bugle became like an actual tabloid, and Peter was like a, what do you call it,
paparazzi?
That's it. He was a paparazzi for a while. And then, so I forget which villain levels the Daily Bugle building. And then they had the whole Peter Parker's mind is replaced by Dr. Octopus and the Superior Spider-Man, which is an episode unto itself. But at the, I just read the other day the new Amazing Spider-Man number 1, and at the end of it, everyone's talking all this trash about what happened to Jonah when he was mayor, and he sees it's all coming from the Daily Bugle. Now he's on a tear to become like the owner and publisher of the Daily Bugle again. So, you know, everything constantly mixed up in Spider-Man's world, and that's one of the things I loved about it. I mean, his neighbors, his landlords, his friends, his jobs. That's one of the things I always loved about Spidey, because there's always this constant change. And I don't know how did you guys go from there.
One of the things that Stan Lee always talked about was the illusion of change, and that was always passed down to the editors-in-chiefs and editors of Marvel, where you could appear to change things, but not really change things. And yet, it always struck me as ironic because Peter Parker was always changing. I mean, he progressed through the colleges. He progressed as a reporter, as a photographer. He progressed as a hero. His cast changed. Things like Flash Thompson being wounded and losing a limb overseas after he joined the military. To the stupid anti-Venom to Venom thing that he's doing now. Talk about that the better.
Agent Venom.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that did lead to an interesting issue of Thunderbolts, where because Thunderbolts right now is really hilarious. It's basically all these red themed Marvel characters in a Suicide Squad-esque squad, where each one right now currently doing a storyline where each member gets to do like a quote unquote loyalty mission. They pull a name out of the hat. Okay, this is the mission this member wants us to do. We'll do it without questions asked. And just previously they went to hell. They met Ghost Rider, and they actually tricked the devil with a contract. The leader actually tricked the devil with a contract, which was actually quite hilarious. Frank Castle almost dies until an angel feather brings him back to life. And he doesn't want to talk about it, Frank Castle, that is. But this all leads to the next issue where Flash Thompson has his request. which is he wants the team to defeat him because he wants to know that if the symbiote ever gets out of control again, that there are people there that can stop him.
Interesting. I mean, to me, I always like the fact that, for the most part, Peter Parker's secondary characters were people. There were a few exceptions, like, and I can't think of his last name. His first name was Hobie.
Hobie Brown. Otherwise,
yeah, the Prowler. Villain turned hero.
Window washer.
Yeah. Mark Raxton. My mind is
not Mark correct. Raxton. He was Liz Allen's brother.
And otherwise known as the Molten Man. And again, he wasn't just generic bad guy. He had progression to where he was taking anger management. He was getting a job. He was getting his stuff, his power under control and living a normal life. It's characters. It's people. It's living. And Peter Parker was probably the greatest representation of the normal man in a comic book world. With one exception. And this does tie in with Spider-Man. And before the show, we talked a bit about Alex Ross. And we have to talk about one of the first works Ross was best known for, a miniseries called Marvels.
Absolutely.
Where the big themes throughout that was Spider-Man's life. I mean, yeah, he dealt a lot with the other Marvels, the other superheroes and supervillains of the Marvel Universe. But what were the things that he kept coming back to? This young girl who just lit up the room whenever she entered the room, who everybody loved, by the name of Gwen Stacy, and her boyfriend, this other photographer for the Bugle, who she didn't like, he didn't like, just never really trusted this Parker kid, to how he got affected by her death, and just Spider-Man. I mean, you can't have the Marvel Universe. I mean, you can have the Fantastic Four, you can have Captain America, you can have the Hulk, but the Marvel Universe is not the Marvel Universe without Spider-Man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's almost like their moral center, you know?
Yeah. And he gets free Hostess cupcakes.
Oh, God, I knew that was coming. But he
also could get some infinite wheat cakes.
Yes, you know? But...
And, of course, we have to... Boy, I can't even believe that I didn't even bring this up, because we have to talk about one of the most important things that Spider-Man ever did.
Yes?
Education.
That is true.
We have to talk about it, because as a parting shot from me, one back in the 70s.
Electric Company?
The Electric Company, where with the Spidey Super Stories. I mean, you had such a great cast with the Electric Company. People like Morgan Freeman, Rita Moreno, Bill Cosby. In fact, the Electric Company was Bill Cosby's thesis for his doctorate. But one of the things they had was the Spidey Super Stories, where a guy in a Spider-Man costume was Spider-Man, would come down and they would solve it. And, of course, everybody is talking except for Spidey, who has voice balloons.
That was so good.
And they even had a print version of Spidey Super Stories back then to tie in with it, where Spider-Man was educational. And you couldn't see Captain America doing that. You couldn't see Reed Richards doing it. You couldn't see Bruce Banner or the Hulk doing it, although that would have been interesting. No, Spider-Man, it had to be Spider-Man it was.
Well, yeah, and you also had not just educational in the show. I mean, you look in the comics with Spider-Man's education. I mean, he'd given up his dreams of going to college for a while, just was a photojournalist for years. You know, then in the 90s, like pre-Clone Saga, you know, he goes back to college to try and finish a degree. Never happened. Then he became, you know, he tried to pass on what he had learned in life, and he became an actual science teacher at his old high school.
And I actually like that. I like that a lot. And
it made a lot of sense.
But the part of the thing that I disliked about that was, you know, there was lots of development with Peter Parker in Flash Thompson's relationship, where they did become genuine friends. And I thought that was great, because I like the part of, you know, Flash Thompson, you know, is multidimensional, not just the bully, because it's so easy for someone to think of a bully as a two-dimensional thing that just exists to harass and torment people.
To be harder honest, a lot of them are just two-dimensional thugs that live to harass and hurt people.
Yeah.
But like I said, I did enjoy the fact that Peter Parker and Flash Thompson built a friendship, and I disliked the fact that when he came out of his coma, he went back to Peter Parker's puny Parker and became the gym coach at the, high school. I disliked that part of it.
Well, it was the to me, because like everybody else, Flash Thompson grew up. And then just like the one more day, they rescinded all of that and returned to the status quo of 30 years ago.
Yes. All right. Well, let's wrap this up. This was our general look at Spider-Man. Next week, I will come back with my review of the not-so-amazing Spider-Man 2. This is yours, Ben.
JT from Saskatoon.
And Walpin Websnappers, I'm Thomas Revoir from 910 Comics. It's 910cmx.com.
And we're saying goodnight.
So long.